The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity, Case 4. The World Honored One points to the ground. The pointer. As soon as a single mote of dust arises, the whole earth is contained therein. With a single horse and a single lance, the lands extended. Who is this person who can be master in any place and meet the source in everything? The main case. As the World Honored One was walking with the congregation, he pointed to the ground with his finger and said, "This spot is good to build a sanctuary." Indra, emperor of the gods, took a blade of grass, stuck it in the ground, and said, "The sanctuary is built." The World Honored One smiled. Hongzhi's verse. The boundless spring on the 100 plants, picking up what comes to hand, he uses it knowingly. The 16-foot tall golden body, a collection of virtuous qualities, casually leads him by the hand into the red dust. Able to be master in the dusts, from outside creation, a guest shows up. Everywhere, life is sufficient in its way, no matter if one is not as clever as others. So this weekend, we've been doing an introductory retreat to Zen practice. Many of you, some of you joining us this morning have been with us this weekend. And this is something that we've been doing every year for, well, as long as I've been here, and before that as well. And so several months ago, we started doing this online, and so here we are. We also, this week, had Thanksgiving, or Day of Gratitude. So I was looking for a koan that would sort of give us some words on that. The pointer, he says, who is this person who can be a master in any place and meet the source in everything? The Buddha realized that everything has what we might call a spiritual basis. What does that mean? When we speak of that which is spiritual or religious, what does that mean? In the Awakening of Faith, it says, there are two gateways based on the Dharma of one mind, Buddha mind. The first is the gateway of the mind to suchness, unified Dharma realm. This neither comes nor goes. It's not born. It never dies. It's free of everything that's false. It's free of definitions of language, naming, and ideas. It's the point at which language runs out. We use words to qualify, affirm, and negate words, but in suchness, there is nothing to affirm or negate. And so this gives us some pointers into that which is the source of everything. It is the place in which language runs out. In Buddhism, when we speak of spirituality or the religious, which is not the language the Buddha used, the Buddha spoke of his path, He spoke of dukkha, suffering, dissatisfaction, disappointment. He pointed to liberation, freedom from that suffering. But his practice and all that he taught pointed to this, this gateway of the mind in which language runs out. Which means language can no longer be used. We can no longer turn towards language to describe this realm. The second gateway of mind is arising and ceasing. This point that is beyond language and naming and ideas, in the Zen tradition, it's said that Bodhidharma described Zen or Chan as that which is a direct pointing to the human mind beyond words and letters, unable to be defined by even by sutras, in a realization of Buddhahood, of enlightenment. The second gateway is that which appears in the world of division, in the world of true and false, right and wrong, of elections, winners and losers, where much is named, there are many ideas. And this is the place where we practice becoming the master, the person who can be master in any place, who can meet the source in everything. And bringing these two together, which really means realizing their unity and that they've always been one thing, is that place this person arrives at. The two truths, conventional and ultimate reality, to be realized as one truth. And the koan, in a sense, is bringing these two gates together in practice. The seated koan is a question, is a phrase, a word. However it's presented, it might be a passage from a sutra, a conversation, whether historically verifiable or not is not the point. The point is that it's pointing towards these gateways of your mind. And it begins within this gateway of rising and ceasing, the gateway of your conceptual mind, your thinking mind. There are words here that the student of the koan takes up and brings into their mind and memorizes, which is the step towards making it, bringing it in closer, beginning to integrate it into their consciousness. And in those words, there are meanings and phrases and images, events, something that's happening, the Buddha walking with the Sangha, pointing to the ground. This is a good spot to build a sanctuary. Indra plants a blade of grass in the ground and says, "The sanctuary is built." The Buddha smiles. So one of the challenges is the student has to understand that everything is here, first of all. Everything that is needed is here. And they have to find their way into the center. It's sort of like when there's a lot of cacophony of voices or opinions or, you know, when there's a lot going on, to be able to see where is the heart of the matter. What do I need to be paying attention to right now? What is actually happening? What is the underlying basis? How do I find my way to the source? Because otherwise we just can get so distracted in all of the activity. So the koan helps us to develop that understanding. And then to take up that question, planting a blade of grass in the ground. How is this a sanctuary? What is sanctuary? And through the strength of your meditation, to not think, to not conjecture, to not project, to not imagine, to not make metaphors, to not do all the things that we know how to do, which so readily give us something, right? Might even give us something that has a little sweetness to it, a little reward. But it's not the point of the koan. The koan wants us to go much deeper than that, beyond the place where language runs out. And so only because of the power of the mind, the strength of one's meditation, is one able to sit with this in such a way that the language carries us beyond itself, into this place free of definition, naming, ideas. And of course, talking about it is not it. And then, having seen the koan on the seat of meditation, so in a sense, working with it as a seated koan, then you have to get up and walk it. How does that insight free you in some measure in your actual life? In one of the fascicles Dogen wrote on suchness, he said, actualizing Buddha ancestors, actualizing wisdom, is reality thoroughly experienced. Reality is all things are reality, suchness. Original nature, suchness, body, suchness, mind, suchness, world, suchness, cloud and rain, suchness. Walking, standing, sitting, and lying down, suchness. Sadness, joy, motion, and stillness, suchness. All of these examples are just representing everything. Nothing is apart from this. What is a sanctuary? A place of refuge? A place of safety? What does that mean? Safety from what? It's a sacred place. It's an inner chamber where the reliquary is found. The relics, the sacred bones, the blood and marrow of wisdom of the enlightened ones. What is this sanctuary the Buddha points to? What makes something a refuge? What makes something sacred? Is it something that is made of stone and wood like this building? Is it in the beauty of the design? If we were sitting in a warehouse and had been sitting in a warehouse for 40 years, that was just a box made of concrete, would that be a refuge? Is it in the design? Is it in the materials? Is it something made of flesh and bones? Is its sacredness something that is inherent within it? Is it something that's created because of what happens in that space? I thought of the various Zendo's meditation halls, halls of awakening, that I've been in over the years in prisons. There were almost always rooms of cinder block and variations on drab paint colors that were made into Zendos for that hour or two and then disassembled and put away. And week after week, month after month, year after year, that space being created as such. When you're at home and you build a space for yourself, you create a space, a corner, a piece of a wall, a room. And each day you go there to sit, you offer incense, you chant the sutras, you do prostrations. What's happening in that space? What becomes of that space? What becomes of you in that space? Is there a relationship going on, coming into being? Some kind of transformation, some kind of magic. I think these are worthwhile questions. We've been in this hall for 40 years. Every week, coming in morning and evening to sit. Each of those days doing services. having Sangha come from all 10 directions and joining us in this space, sitting hours after hours after hours, days after days. In good times and bad times, highs and lows, joyful and sorrowful, delighted and weeping, feeling strong and resilient, feeling defeated and despairing. Sessions every month, even more of all of that. What happens in a space like this? Why is that important? Why is a sanctuary important? Why did the Buddha want to build a sanctuary? Some of you are leaving residency. Many of you will leave residency at some point. And when you leave, what do you take with you? What do you leave behind? What's been going on all this time, after all? We create altars with images of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas or photos of ancestors, family ancestors, Buddhist ancestors. People place stones, flowers, pieces of wood, meaningful objects. I have a piece of the Berlin Wall that someone gave me years ago. A piece from a stone from a cave, another gift that someone took from a cave in which it was said Ananda practiced at the time of the Buddha. We bring these objects into our space, into the altar. Why? To inspire, to remind, to bring us closer to something, to some sense of some deep place of intimate encounter. Hopefully we've all had moments of sacredness, of sanctuary. You might have had a place where you, when you grew up, that you went to. Kind of private place, a secret place. When I lived in the city for 10 years at the temple, I very quickly, as we got settled, I began looking on Hosan, going out on my bicycle and walking and just looking, where is the place here? Here, where I'd been for so many years, those places were already very familiar to me. But in the city, where were those places? And I went out looking for that space or spaces of refuge. And found them. We have moments, whether they're with family or friends, maybe in relationship to the earth, that are important, that bring us closer, that engender that sense of gratitude, of intimacy, of appreciation. And they come and they can be very powerful, and then they go. They leave us. Sanctuaries are like that too. This monastery one day will not be here. Everything that is built up, the Buddha said, comes apart. If it's a sacred space you've built in your home, one day you'll move from that place or you will no longer live there. Is there a sacred place, is there a sanctuary that is not built, that is not of your doing? Indra took a blade of grass and planted it in the ground and said, the sanctuary is built. And the Buddha smiled. In the sutras, whenever the Buddha smiled, everyone took notice. Because it was said the Buddha never smiled except when something important was taking place. a simple blade of grass. It's as fleeting as a single season. There are millions of them. He took one and planted it. How is that a sanctuary? Wendell Berry said, nothing. There's not a single thing that is not sacred. There's only that which we have desecrated. There's only that which we have so distorted that it no longer appears easily as sacred. To be that person who can be master in any place, to meet the source in everything, we have to have some faith and enough to begin letting go. To begin letting go of what we know, of the places that we name, that we create as objects, that we use, wrap our language around. Begin to let go of what we know about ourselves and things, about love and hate, about serenity and anguish, to let go of our thinking mind and enter into this source in everything, this reality of one true thing. Indra took a blade of grass. The first koan is Mu. Many teachers have held up a stick. Is there anything that is not true? Do we see the implications of this? Of reality thoroughly experienced. Reality is all things. All things are reality suchness. Think of the implications of this. Reflecting on that now, where would you go and not be in its midst? In the midst of this gateway of your own liberation. As soon as a single mote arises, the whole earth is contained. And to really appreciate that these are not just words of poetry or metaphor or imagination. In a certain sense, they're not teaching stories, which can be wonderful and powerful and are used in Buddhism. But this is not that. This is something different. This is really a direct pointing. These are simple words, really. A simple moment. And intentionally simple so that it doesn't clutter in its pointing to this reality thoroughly experienced. And that's our work. Within the koan, it is to enter into that and thoroughly experience reality. And to realize that, to experience that as your own body and mind. As your life, as the world, because there is no other thing. There is no other place. There is no other refuge. We are not waiting for a better place. Well, that maybe should be a question. The Buddha's teaching encourages us, lays out for us, that we ought not to waste our time waiting for a better place, a better time, a better opportunity, a better mood, a better energy. Until we're in a better state that's better. Not this one. You know, the reasons not to practice are, well, it's a long list. And when we begin practicing, that list starts to be drawn up. Maybe before we begin practicing. Maybe we never get to practice because that list is already quite full. When we practice, they will appear, those many reasons not to practice, and they will challenge us. And when they don't just appear, we might just go out and look for one. And along the way, hopefully one thing we discover is that it's in your hands. And that's not a statement of not caring or a lack of empathy or desire for each of us to awaken to our own lives. It's just a fact. It's just a simple fact that the whole of this is in our hands. Even if we raise a great aspiration, bodhicitta, and commit ourselves to practice, that doesn't mean that the sanctuary is immediately going to appear before our eyes or within us. The sense of estrangement, of separation, of isolation is so old. An old master, Chinese master, Zhuai Feng, said, "The entire great earth is a gate of emancipation. Even if I invite people, they would not get through it." And Dogen, commenting on this, said, "So know that although the entire great earth is a gate of emancipation, raise a single mote of dust and the whole earth is contained." And by the way, the whole entire earth is a gate of emancipation. All of those gates are open. Dogen says, in spite of all this, going in and out is not easy. There are not many who go in and out. Even if they're invited, they would not go in and out. Even if they're not invited, they don't go in and out. Those who even step forward may miss it. Those who step backwards will likely just stand still. How is this? If you try to have others go in and out of the gate, it seems to move further away. If you have a gate which accepts everything, then it's possible to go in and out. What is it about this elusive gate? If your very body and mind is the mind of the Buddha, if everything that arises is a great gate of emancipation, if you already possess fully enlightened nature and all of the qualities of a Buddha, if the sanctuary is nothing other than your very being, then what's all this fuss about? Why is it not easy? So we point to the depth of our conditioned habits, the way we perceive things, our false views, our attachments, our fears, our obstructive emotions, and so on. By the way, just for clarification, last week I was talking about the kleshas, these obstructive emotions, and I said that they're much more, in Buddhism, they're considered much more sort of binding, powerful, important than thoughts. I want to clarify that. By thoughts, I meant just the sort of stream of thoughts that pass by, that we get so entangled in. But not views. Views being the basic ways, the essential ways that we understand the world to be. Those are the deepest sources of our entanglement. Right? In that sense, emotions are much easier to work with. Views are much deeper. Right? And these are not just like our political beliefs and, you know, our opinions about, you know, sort of everyday things. These are really fundamental existential beliefs that we can really not even be aware that we have. Just to clarify. And so all of these things that function within us that don't allow us to see things as they are, people, creatures, mountains and rivers, situations, and so we can stand outside on a glorious day like this, surrounded by life, a mountain, rivers, trees, or we can stand in the middle of the city in the midst of that particular miracle and not see a sanctuary, not experience sacredness. And not perceiving it and not seeing it that way, it's almost inevitable that we will misuse it, harm it in some way. I was in just reflecting on this week of Thanksgiving and how it's been sort of presented to us historically within our own particular narrative in this country. I went back to read some of the eyewitness accounts of a contemporary of Columbus, late 1400s, early 1500s, Bartolomé de las Casas, who traveled around the West Indies observing. And he actually later met with King, I think, Ferdinand, I might be incorrect there, later to argue, to make an argument about why the indigenous people of these lands, this new world, should not be enslaved on religious grounds. He did not convince the king. But in his own words, this is what he said. Of all the infinite universe of humanity, and he's talking about the Arawak, the Taino people, the indigenous people. He said, of all the infinite universe of humanity, these people are the most guileless, the most devoid of wickedness and duplicity, the most obedient and faithful to their native masters and to the Spanish Christians whom they serve, having been put into servitude. They are by nature the most humble, patient, peaceable, holding no grudges, free from embroilments. They're neither excitable nor quarrelsome. These people are the most devoid of rancors and hatreds or desire for vengeance of any people in the world, any people he had ever seen. They're poor people, for they not only possess little, but they have no desire to possess. He talks about a story of one of the chiefs, the tribal chiefs, who fled one island because the Spaniards were massacring everybody. He went to another island, and he told them that the Spaniards were coming and that they were coming looking for gold. And so they brought out these huge baskets of gold, and they said, well, maybe we should just give them to them. And he said, no, they'll just want more. And so they said, well, then let's just throw them in the river. So they did. They just threw it all in the river. Said, we'll just get rid of it so they can't find it. They won't. Maybe that will stop them. It didn't. And so then he went on to speak, having described them in this way. So he was seeing them this way. And then he went on to describe those Spaniards, he said, the colonists, behaving like ravening wild beasts, wolves, tigers, lions, as though they had been starved for many days, who behaved in no other way during the past 40 years down to the present time, still acting like ravening beasts, killing, terrorizing, afflicting, torturing, destroying, and doing all of this with the strangest and most varied methods of cruelty, never seen or heard before, such that the population which he estimated to be 3 million, has now become barely 200. The history we were not taught. And so in our service on Thursday, we began with remembering those who occupied this land and who loved it. We can only imagine, having lived here for thousands and thousands of years, and having had their own sophisticated forms of language and commerce and travel and government, that we're not seen, that we're not recognized as such, that we're not valued. And then we turned our attention to atonement. Even though we did not commit those actions, many hundreds of years ago, we living here benefit from them. And so how do we atone now for the actions of our ancestors? And then how do we move forward into gratitude? And that's why I think history is a fundamentally spiritual endeavor. To really turn towards the true story, or the truer story. How can we not encounter humanity and all of its appearances? How can we not have our heart broken? How can we not be enraged? How can we not be despairing of humanity at times? To think of what not only we are capable of, but what we have actually done and do. And then how do we come to life in the midst of that? How do we live forward in that? The Buddha said we live in a fundamentally, unescapably moral world. We cannot escape it. How do we find our way in? Recognizing that anything that's taken by force, that's generated by hatred, violence, control and domination, that those very forces must continue. Not just because of a kind of karmic momentum, but anything taken by force has to be held by force. It doesn't end until it stops. There can be no peace, no relaxation, no happiness, no trust, ultimately. Who was it? Somebody was just quoting. I don't remember who it was. Somebody, some great changer of the world said that if people who think that there's no place for politics and religion doesn't understand either. What is not political? When one person appears in the world, it's political. Because we bring everything with us. And so what is the connection between all of that and this koan? This is a good spot to build a sanctuary. I stick a blade of grass into the ground. The sanctuary is built. What's the connection? If we want to know the source of our healing, we have to go to the source of our illness. Because they're not separate from each other. See, that's the thing. That's why these two truths, this two truths teaching is so important, because otherwise we would think, I'm just going to realize the ultimate, thank you very much, and I'll just leave this conventional reality behind. Or I'll just enter into the mind, the gateway of suchness, and leave behind the gate of arising and ceasing, of names and language and ideas. Just for the record, nobody's ever done that. No one has ever succeeded. How can I say that? I say that with some confidence. Because I don't know how that anyone could succeed, because it's not the world that we live in. It's not reality. And so if we want to understand the reality before our eyes, the actual one, what the Buddha was enlightened to is we have to understand our one mind. And the mind of all sentient beings, because they're not two. And so he must take a blade of grass. He must take something that is impermanent. He must take something that has a name and stick it in the ground and say, this is the sanctuary you were looking for. That may get us our attention, but it doesn't bridge the gap yet. That's what each of us has to do. That's what practice is. And to do that, we have to let go of the one that we each attach to as ourself. That's all. And that is the whole earth. And so we do it, moment by moment, day by day, step by step. And so in the poem, he says, Mongjer says, the boundless spring on the 100 plants. This is the entire great earth is a gate of emancipation. Each moment, each mind state, every object, every time, it's not somewhere else. Picking up what comes to hand, he uses it knowingly, Indra. The God, Emperor of the Gods, uses it knowingly. And that's really what our practice is. To pick up whatever you have at hand and to use it knowingly. I mean, reflect on that. What that means is that more and more than the whole world becomes an abundance of things that now become useful. The footnote to that says, going into a wild field, not choosing. Not saying, no, there's nothing here. Let's keep moving. The 16-foot golden body, this is used oftentimes to describe the body of the Buddha, a collection of virtuous qualities. Casually, leads him by the hand into the red dust. The red dust is the world. It's all of the stuff that gets in your eyes, that clogs your ears, that clouds your mind, leaves a ring in the bathtub. Casually, relaxedly, necessarily leads you by the hand into the red dust. That's what practice does. If you thought you were going to be getting away from all of it, that's not true, and I'm not sorry to say so. Although I would have been sorry to hear that, and I actually was when I first came into training. I was trying to get away from the red dust. What does that mean? Turn towards the sanctuary. Quiet your basic mind. See what arises. Begin to understand within your knowing, and then begin to understand beyond your knowing. Come closer. Take responsibility. Gain your confidence. The footnote to that says, one day the authority is in your hands. Really what that means is one day you realize it's never been any other way. And now, able to be master in the dusts, mastering the dusts, from outside of creation, a guest shows up, something appears, a situation, a crisis, a decision, a person, a stranger, a friend, an enemy. A guest shows up. The footnote says, observe when the imperative goes into effect. Daroshi used to often speak of the spiritual imperative, the imperative to meet on the ground of truth, that which has appeared. what we begin to see is the world is nothing but a place of guests. Every day, everywhere. That spiritual imperative, it's like each of us deciding for ourselves if we want to live. We have life, but if we want to live, actually. You know, we make sure that we shop for our food, we wash our dishes, we clean the clothes, we go to work, we pay the bills, because if we don't, the consequences are obvious. Things begin to fall apart. But what are the consequences of our delusion, of our estrangement, of our greed, of our anger, of not attending to our mind? What are the consequences of that? What are the consequences of our distraction? Do we know? Have we studied this? Well, if we want to begin studying, just look around. Just look around. The consequences are everywhere. And yet all along, Hongzhi says, everywhere life is sufficient in its way. And the footnote says, it doesn't come from others. And this well-worn teaching, no one can give it to you. But it takes so long to really take that in, to believe it. No matter if you're not as clever as others. Doesn't matter. Footnote says, no color of shame on your face. I hear him saying, why don't you just leave the race? Step out of the competition. Not because you've accepted defeat, but because you've decided there has to be another way. And the thing is, we can't find another way until we stop going the old way. See, that's the thing. We will never find a solution to war until we stop going to war. That's the thing. And that's why courage is required. And not just once. And when we begin to return home and find our own completeness, our own sufficiency, then you know. You know your strengths and weaknesses because they've helped you get there. You know, what we call our weaknesses, our obstructions, our deep dispositions and inclinations that keep arising and arising and arising, and we just want them to go away, and why won't they go away? I thought I had taken care of this. Those are the things that are helping us to work out our own particular path. Their persistence, their strength, means they have great power. No color of shame on the face. This is a path of no regret. While we stumble and fumble and make mistakes and take responsibility again, and so, particularly for those of you who joined us for the weekend, I just want to encourage you to continue in some true direction. So you spent the weekend with us and we sort of laid bare our chest as a way to offer you a bit of what is happening here within this particular Dharma path. And now you will take this in and take a next step. And my encouragement is just to do that. And whether it's in this direction or a different direction or an altogether different direction, but just make sure it's a true path, one worthy of your sincere effort. I'll end with a poem. Waiting by the door is the story of always tomorrow. Always tomorrow is the story of never today. And never today is an elusive shadow. Though it seems to persist, can you find it now? When the moon finally casts its eternal light, now we see. There never was a lonely place, only vast solitude. Now we see each and every one has the wealth of the entire world. And from here, boundless gratitude flows forth effortlessly. So may we be grateful. May we be grateful for the abundance of having life, and having encountered this Dharma. And if we don't have that gratitude, that's okay. That's okay. Just wonder a bit about that.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.